Hi, everybody. My name is Willie, and I'm from here from Southern California. I'm a past delegate of Panel 37, Southern California South. Wow. I've just been handled a great sense of humility, because to be able to, to have to show up after what I just heard from Don is just, has to be a power greater than me to help to have me stick around and not run and hide from someone who has just given such a warm share and just talked Al-Anon for what it is. But I'd like to start with like someone else read earlier, I'd like to start with step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And what that tells me that I've the first 11 steps you guys gave it to me, and step 12 say that I is the only thing in Al-Anon that tells us we got to give it back. I have to give it. That's an oath that I took. Oath that I took when I took these 12 steps, these first 11 steps, and all of you guys reach your hands out to me, then it told me when. They only asked me, Al-Anon asked me to do one thing, and that's in step 12, to carry this message to others. And the second thing I must do is to practice these principles in all my affairs, because that's what they're going to see. They're going to see a lot more than they hear. So I'd like to start. First, I want to thank Yvonne for asking me to do this. Again, like I say, if I caught you around the block, I'd punch you one for having me follow Don. This is hard. So, but God, you up there. If I ever need you, I need you now. So any of that, it all happened to me. I like to talk about where it started. I was born in a little town called Galveston, Texas. That was many, many years ago. Not quite as many years ago as Don, but at least 81 years ago. And it's so funny, I was born in the oldest hospital in the state of Texas. And I grew up in the oldest city in the state of Texas. I grew up in Galveston, Texas. During those days, I grew up in the days before there was desegregation. So I want you to watch this migration of where we come from. When I grew up, we were colored. They had colored restrooms and white restrooms. And then we went from color to being Negroes in the 60s and King days. Then we got to the point where we had Afro-American. Then we became African-Americans, but then we got to Black. And all the old days when the big Afros and James Brown said loud, I'm Black and I'm proud, And so we start getting some symptoms of being Black again. And today now we're being called people of color. So can you imagine trying to find an identity if you don't have a good self-sense of who you are in this world? So I like to share what it was like to me. My family wasn't, my mom and dad, neither one drank. And I had two sisters, one sister that's older and one that's almost 11 years younger. And both my mom and dad were, both of them were the oldest, was the first born in their child. But strangely enough, both of my grandmother's surnames, my first grandmother, my mother's grandmother, mother's mom was Williams, and my father was a Williams. So somewhere down this train, way back in those days, those Williams hooked up. So I know that it's been read to me that I'm like my great grandparents were slaves. So I know that if you do the math, I'm 81. You just count back and you read back to my grandparents. I know my grandmother was probably the second youngest of 13, and many of her older siblings were born during slavery time. So when I grew up there in Texas, I had these dreams, you know. I was kind of born into a way of life. If you're born in it, you just adapt to it. Don't mean you like it. You don't feel something a little different. Like when I used to have to, my mom would walk me to the city bus stop. And if the bus, it could be raining outside. And if the bus was crowded in the back, no matter what it was in the front, they would pass you up. Then if I did get on, they say, push you, go far, far to the back and the front. What kind of message was that given to a youngster? But that was the message I got. But one of the things that my grandmother used to tell me all the time, she said, son, she called me Booney. You know, in Texas, you know, everybody has nicknames. So she called me Booney and said, I want to tell you something. You get an education, you read, you learn as much as you can, because that is the one thing no one can ever take away from you. So I did that. As in my young family, I only remember my mom, my parents having these parties. And I had this one uncle. My mother was one of five, and they were all different shades. I had one uncle that is dark as the black on your screen here. They were from Louisiana. And I had another uncle that was very fair-skinned. They called him Red. He had red with freckles. And he lived in Kansas City, Missouri. So he would come to town. When they come to town, his wife, my aunt, and my mom and dad, and my aunt and her husband, they all would go out on Friday night. They go out and party. My mom and dad and his wife and my aunts and uncle would all come home on Friday. He come home on Tuesday. So you know who he was. So any event, he was my favorite uncle. Why wouldn't we all love them alcoholics? Now, I can't call him that because he never went to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I do know that that he was my favorite uncle, and he would send me these fancy suits, and that's probably why I dressed the way I do today, from Kansas City. And I'd take him to school. I'd wear one to school, and all my buddies who didn't have one like it wanted to wear it to the school dance the next time. So that's what kind of impact that uncle had on me. In Texas, that was only one thing you could do in Galveston, was to kind of job. You can work longshore, or you can do some of those things. But I always wanted to be a self-employed in a small business and run a business. And they didn't offer none of that at the time I grew up. So at the age of 17, I ran off. I ran off with my high school sweetheart. We went to Denver, Colorado. And we started our journey of having children. We weren't married. We had, like, 9 months later after we ran to Colorado. Well, let me stop a minute. We stayed in Denver for about 3 months. Let me tell you what happened there. When I left, I ran off, you know. I had a buddy of mine pick me up in the middle of the night and take us to the bus station. And when I got to the bus station, I had just enough for me and my girlfriend to take off and take this trip to Denver, Colorado. And we started, like I say, started doing things on that trip that teenagers weren't supposed to do, boo. And then 9 months later, she had our first child. You know, 1 year and 2 months later, she had our second child, 2 weeks later. And then we stayed in Texas. By that time, we had gone back to Texas. But let me tell you, I left Denver. When I got to Denver, my mom, my parents had found me, and they told me, said, hey, Willie, why don't you go to California where I have some relatives? I said, oh, Mom, that's why I left Texas, because you're always trying to tell me what to do. And so she kept calling, and it got, this was in, I left in May. And when I got to Colorado, I saw all that snow and ice on the mountains, even in June and July. And it was hot. And I said, what kind of message is this? And I just brought summer clothes with me. So in September, I think it was Labor Day weekend, all of a sudden, God in his infinite wisdom, phew, looked like he turned the switch down. And I called my mom up that very next day and said, Mom, what about some of them relatives you have in California? And that's how I left Denver and got to California. We stayed there for a little bit. And I went back to Texas for a couple of years, and I came back to California. It was then I had never been in out of the South. So when we got to Denver, the first thing I asked, where was the colored folk part of town? And they told me to go down on the Five Points. But that's what you program like. It wasn't until I got here and got here for a while that I could see things differently. So that's enough a little bit about that part. I got to get to the alcoholism because that's why I'm here. But what happened with the third child? We were here in California, and my other two boys was back in Texas. I sent them back to live with my parents because it was so rough out here. And she was going to school, and I was just making barely enough to feed us. And so she came up with this great idea that let's put the child up for adoption. And I was a member, first of all, I was born in the oldest hospital in the state of Texas. I was a member of the first Black Baptist church in the state of Texas. First graduated from the first Black high school in the state of Texas. And any of you people, I saw some people on here from Texas. They'll know about Central High, which was the first Black high school in the state of Texas. And so it was a lot of firsts. And so I get here and I put my son up for adoption. And that was the cardinal sin. You just can't do that in the church. And I just could feel for what Don was saying about that, because it felt okay until I was at California Hospital and the nurse brought the baby to us. She held him, then she gave him to me. And that lasted about 5 minutes. And then she said, okay, we got to go now. And she took him out of my hand. And when she took that boy out of my hand, it felt like a big hole had just been opened in my gut. I could never stand up again straight for a long time. And so I went through life just causing a whole wreck of trying to find Mrs. Wright, trying to find myself, trying to measure up, know that I had this dirt and this shame on me because I had given up my son for adoption. So I went through just a ton of relationships and marriages. And then I met this lady and she had a drinking problem. I didn't know that at the time, because when I first began to chat with her, I said, you've been coming in here a while, and I know you said that that you had just lost your job. And let me back up. When she first came in, I said, well, and she would talk. We would have these conversations. So I said to her, I said, maybe I could bring you over your favorite drink and some cigarettes. And what she said to me is, you know, I'm not drinking tonight. That's what she said. What I heard was that I'm a working girl. I have this 2-year-old at home and I don't drink. That ain't what she said, but that's what I heard. And later on, I found out later after her mom passed away that at the funeral, at any of these Black funerals, you, if some of you guys on the screen, well, I'm looking at a screen full of people like me now. I'm not used to seeing this. So you know that at the funerals, they have all this food and stuff after the funeral. And then you have the group with the brown bags. I didn't know that she was part of the brown bag group until that day. And that started my journey of trying to fix that situation. I felt that I was smarter, older, and bright enough to be able to defeat that disease that she had been carrying around for all of her life. So I only share you a couple things about that. I'll carry a couple stories about that marriage, about that relationship. One being that we had this neighbor upstairs that drank and partied a lot. So while being there, she would go upstairs a lot when I come home from work. So one night I went up there, and boy, they were really partying, and she and another little friend was partying, a little bit too much. And I came downstairs, and like any Al-Anon, who don't have a lot of self-confidence, I came down, and she came down later and said, and I said to me, I saw you, and guess what I saw? And she said, oh, wait a minute. No. Let me tell you what really happened. And that's when I learned that I not only could not hear, but I couldn't see what I thought I saw either. So, and I say to most of the guys and men and women in my life, when I'm dealing with somebody with the alcohol issue, just that to know that when the alcoholic begin to open their mouth and they tell you what really happened, you run the other way. So get out of the way as fast. Go back to jail and stop. Just get out of the way. But during that time, I don't know like about you, because you guys think us men are different than women. But I had my Al-Anon sweats, whereas some of you guys may have your Al-Anon robes, you know, those veneer robes you talk about, you pinch everything off. Well, I had my Al-Anon sweats look just like your robes with holes in them and stuff. But I wanted to keep them on because I didn't know, wanted her to know if I was going to bed or getting up. Most of the time I wasn't going to bed. I was looking out that window right in my front room that had these, Venetian blinds that I had cracked them so much that they had prints on my forehead, and you could see them, that most blinds go across like that, but mine would do this, had that bow in it where I was looking at it all the time. And I don't know about you, but I got to the point where I could tell from the way, the cadence of her walk, if she had been drinking or not. So when she would walk into the door, I asked that stupid question that most of us ask, have you been drinking? Duh. So after this one incident, we had this big fight, and I got so angry, I tore up everything in the house, broke up all the dishes and threw silverware everywhere. But guess who had to clean it up? Duh. Well, one more time, I thought that I would try. I thought if she knew how she acted when she drank, that she wouldn't do it. So I say, I got this tape recording. Let's play this tape. And so I put the tape, bought her favorite drink, put the tape on, and the night ended up just like every other night. But only this time, I had the evidence. So when she got up in the morning, I said, okay, let me tell you what really happened. So I put this tape on, started playing. She said, oh, I did that? I say, yeah. So I did that too. I say, yeah. And say, what? Oh, well, keep them playing. Let me tell you what else would really happen. So in any event, she did like most alcoholics do. She swore that she would never, ever, never, ever do that again. And so, oh, I forgot to tell you guys. Remember the time I broke up all the dishes and stuff I told you? I thought that would work because the next day went to Vegas and got married. So that was the first time. So that was my second time out. I'm thinking that I can fix her. And that's why I tried the tape thing. And that didn't work on her, but it did work for me. Because she got drunk that same night. But the only thing different, I went to work and I had this one friend that was still in my office that would still talk to me. I don't know about you, but I had chased all of my good friends away. But, you know, because it was always, let me tell you what really happened. Let me tell you this. And they just got tired to hear. So after a while, I went to this one friend. She said, Willie, let me tell you where there's a meeting down on St. Andrew's Place in Weston, St. Andrew's Place in Wilshire. I want you to show that. I've got a friend that's going to meet you there. I'll be there at 7:30. So I get in the car. I dress up, sort of like I'm dressed now, because I didn't know where I was going. I thought I was going to one of these direct marketing places like Amway, whatever one of those kinds those pyramid things that talk about the direct marketing. Then I show up at that meeting. I walk in the back place and they've got all the guys with cigarette smoke and laughing and talking and high-fiving themselves. And you guys know who they were. Then I went upstairs and on the stairs on the way up, there were these group of kids with spiked hair and all kinds of stuff. And you guys, they were the Alateen. Then I walked into this room, you know, remember, I'm still trying to find Mrs. Rice because things ain't working for me. So I walk into this room and there was all of these ladies. Remember, this is in 1987, I believe. Yeah, 1987. Not only was not very many men here in these rooms, there was very few men with this tan that I have. So I walk into this room and, oh God, I was in heaven and heaven and God's heaven. I walk in the room and I sit in the back of the room and I didn't want to look like a newcomer. And you guys know that nothing looks more like a newcomer than a newcomer. So I sat down between these two ladies and I didn't hear nothing the people said other than the fact that keep coming back. And I wasn't about to come back there again because I had never heard of Al-Anon before. In the hood, because I grew up at that time here in L.A., I was in Compton. So in the hood, we didn't hear anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing we heard about AA was a way to keep from going to jail. So when I would go back home and tell my buddies that I had been to an Al-Anon meeting, and they would just say, what kind of meeting? I said, an Al-Anon meeting. They said, oh man, what are they going to teach you? So in any event, I kept coming back. A lot of you guys said it took you forever to get a sponsor, not me. The very next morning, I tossed and turned because those two ladies at the end of the meeting, at that time we used to have these little things we write our names on, gave me their phone numbers. And I couldn't wait to call them because remember, I got another motive. I don't have the motives of getting serenity. But I had a different motive. I was trying to find Mrs. Wright. I had one Mrs. Wright at home, but that wasn't good enough. So any event that for me and my sick thinking. So any event, I kept this up and I called one of the ladies the next morning and she said, I got to go to work. And he called my friend, I called a friend, and I started my little, 13-step rap and stuff, and didn't work. She 12-stepped me and became my sponsor. And she started sponsoring me the way sponsors supposed to sponsor, as I saw it. That she had that disease of get in the car. And I don't know if you guys been struck by that disease by your sponsors, but mine definitely say get in the car. At that time, she was on the service board, and I think she was the literature coordinator or something like that. And we used to, and she needed help taking literature different places. So we had this case. So we would bag this case up and go to these, you know, here in LA, we could go to these health fairs and workshops and conventions and things. And I'd help her unload the literature. But one of the things by dealing with the literature, you get a chance to read some of it. So, and I'm not much of a reader, so I had to really catch my eye. I could only read the short pamphlets. So I hung on, the thing I hung on to was the do's and don'ts. At my big Sunday night meeting, they had what was called, it was a big group and they needed coffee people. So it took four people to make coffee. So four of us at the coffee time got together. And we thought we were going to prove them that we could make the best coffee in Southern California. And what happened? During the week, we had to call each other up. And so, without knowing, God was putting his touches on me then, because there was nobody in those rooms that looked like me. Especially no males, and every now and then I'd see a female that had the same tan that I had. So what happened? That was a blessing because I had no other place to run and hide. I had to trust you because I was tired of feeling the way I felt. And when you put me in the rooms with your children, you trusted me with your children. And it was your children, the Alateens, that slowly started showing me that unconditional love that only they can do. Us adults think we can, but my wife today used to bring a kid who was a paraplegic to a Southern California Alateen conference here. And those kids, when she got him there, she had to do nothing else. Those kids would make sure that he got food. They made sure that they come up and talk to him. He didn't look like a paraplegic there. And I'm sure he didn't feel like that. At the time, I had married a lady when I got here who had three sons. One of them had epilepsy, and he don't mind me sharing that because he would tell you that. And when he got out of the hospital after his brain surgery, I called, SCAC was his very next weekend, and I called the chair of SCAC that day. I said, he just got out of the hospital. Can I bring him? He said, bring him. I got him to SCAC, and those kids just took him, just enveloped. I didn't have to worry about him until we got ready to leave. They made sure he ate, and they made sure I knew where he was, how he was, and all those things that only they knew how to do. And that's when I begin to see the love here. That's when this old man, who had this big hole in his gut, began to learn to straighten up and stand straight and look you in the eye and say, hey, my name is Willie. I'm a proud member of this fellowship. Later on, my sponsor would tell me, Willie, when a service position come up, put your hand up. You know, and it got to the point when I would be in the meeting, a position would come up, I had to snatch it and keep my hand down. So that was a meeting that I was going up to a family meeting, and a guy there said, hey, Willie, we are going to start a men's Al-Anon group. I say, okay, where? I say, in La Cañada. So please, you guys, take this okay. In La Cañada, even the cop cars are white there. So what am I going to do up in La Cañada? So I show up in La Cañada with these men group, and this was almost 30 years ago, 29 years ago, and we started this meeting, and I'm the last one of the original members there, of the original members who is still there. And that group has produced some of the best Al-Anon circuit speakers, you know. I mean, we have guys from there that go all around the country and carry this message. Why? Because we got to have a meeting that we feel was the best the best damn Al-Anon meeting in the world. So in that group, they say, okay, Willie, we need a GR. So I became a GR. Then they say, well, in this same area, say it's time now for a DR. So I in that area, they was kind of an old grandfather rule, whereas the district rep would just appoint somebody to be that successor. So one of the angels in the room said, hey, no, we can't do that this year. I had mentored the DR before them. And they said, let's have an election. So they had the election. I won the election. I became DR. So the next journey, during this time, I was an Alateen sponsor. And I got to sponsor the Alateens in the 1995 big Al-Anon AA convention down in AA Al-Anon convention down in San Diego. It was the Al-Anon World Convention. And that was a good thing. I had over 1,000 kids from all over the world. So when the assembly came up in 96, I was in the room, I was a DR, and a couple of the past delegates say, hey, are you going to stand for delegate? I say, not really. I hadn't thought about it. And my sponsor said, are you going to stand? I say, well, I don't know. I may stand for treasurer or something, because that's something I know how to do. And she said to me, just as blunt as she could, what make you think you get to pick and choose? You just get to stand. You don't get to pick and choose who's going to do this work. God, that's God's job. So about 13 of us went up there and they all told why they stood. I just told them, well, my sponsor made me do it. So at the end of the election, it was over and we got down to two and my name came out the hat. And when I got to, it was the first year that we were doing the World Service Conference in Virginia Beach. And not only did I show up at Virginia Beach, and I was on this, there was one other Black person there, and she was worked in the office as one of the assistant associate directors. And that was also Rick, who was our former executive director for many years. That was his first full conference on his own. And Rick will call me from time to time now. But that's, again, when I learned about not only the 12 steps, how they work, but how the 12 concepts work. And I also began to see that I could see people from on the left side and the right side go up to the podium and just argue their point of view. You think they're going to fight afterwards. And after they get to just trying to talk their points up, at lunchtime, you see them all sitting around at the same table, just laughing and saying, like nothing has happened. That's when I learned that they were just looking out for the they were just remembering our common welfare come first. And we needed unity. So didn't mean we need to be unified. We just need to have unity. So we didn't all have to think alike and wear the same color shoes. We just had to, we could go up there and give our point of view. And after they take the group conscious in the second step, we get to second tradition, we get to abide by. So that's what it was like. And after I got to these rooms, I don't see this little boy from Galveston, Texas, all of a sudden didn't see the color of your skin or the gender. All I know is that we all suffer from the same disease. I've had a sponsoring meeting in my home for the last 26 years, and it's probably only two of those guys are men of color. So my wife's wedding about 4 years ago, I only have one guy who's my best man who actually died of disease of, COVID took him out 2 months ago. And boy, I'm really, really sad me about that. But what I'm saying here, when I was delegate, I went to a meeting down in South Central. And that was a guy that came up to me and said, "Hey, Willie, brother, I'm sick of all these folks. Let's start us a black meeting." I said, "What?" He said, "I want to start Black Al-Anon." I said, "Hey, man, what?" I said, "Let me get back to you." So I went away, and then I went to a SoCal convention down in San Diego. I ran into another buddy of mine who's men of color. He was in AA. I say, "Milty, this guy said he wants to start a black meeting." Milton paused for about 5 minutes, Black Al-Anon. He paused for about 5 minutes. And I said, "I don't know what to say." He said, "Here's what I tell you. You tell him, if you can find some whiskey that only make black folk drunk, then you are considered." So that's when I got, that was a prime example of how the disease of alcohol has no borders. It has no color about it. It has no gender, no ages, no color, no countries. It spans this whole world, and the results of it is the same. So I stand before you I'd like to read something that I read when my sponsor and I got to talk a couple of, on Valentine's weekend, because it's getting close to my time. It's a poem that I read that's called No Choice. Before I read this, I have to say this to you. About 47 years and 4 days, my son came back into my life. We had 4.5 years, good years together. His mom and I got to witness his marriage in Hawaii. He came to me about a week in March, and he said, "I want to meet my little brother, because you, Dad, you're getting older. I want to make sure that I'm here for him when you go." That next weekend, my son said, "Oh, they had such a great time, my youngest boy." 3 days later, his kidney failed on him, and he passed away. But I was there at his bedside. I kissed him goodbye, and where did I go? I went back to my Thursday night Al-Anon meeting and took my, I think, 26 or 27-year cake at that time. And those guys, I went where the love was. Those guys loved me, and that's how I celebrated. I took my cake at 7:30, and I got the phone call that he died about 7:30. He died when I was in the space where I needed to be. So I want to read this little poem that I read to you guys when my sponsor Bob was on. Bob had been my sponsor for almost 30 years now. And he's guided me all along. And this thing is called No Choice. And it says, "My little boy came to the kitchen this evening while I was fixing supper. And he handed me a piece of paper and he had been writing on. So after wiping my hands on my apron, I read it, and this is what I said. For mowing the lawn, $5. For making my own bed this week, $1. For going to the store, 50 cents. For playing with baby brother while you went shopping, $25. For taking out the trash, $1. For getting a good report card, that's $5. For raking up the leaves, $2. So the mother, which is, I feel this Al-Anon, and I say the same thing to my sponsor, Bob. Well, I looked at him with standing there. This is him looking at me, standing there with expectantly, and a thousand memories flashed through my mind. So I picked up the paper and turned it over, and this is what I wrote. This is the mind writing, the mom writing. For the 9 months I carried you, growing inside me, no charge. For the night I sat up with you, doctored you, and prayed for you, no charge. For the time and the tears and the cost of your years, no charge. For the nights filled with dread and worries ahead, there's no charge. For advice and knowledge and the cost of your college, no charge. For the toys, food, and clothes, and for wiping your nose, there's no charge, son. When you add it all up, the full cost of my love is no charge. Well, when he finished reading, he had great big tears in his eyes, just like I got right now. And he looked up at me and said, Mom, and I'll say Al-Anon and Bob, I sure do love you. Then he took the pen, and with great big tears, he wrote, paid in full. When you add it all up, the cost of your real love is no charge. Thank each and every one of you for paying this 12-step call on me today. Yvonne, I love you, my dear. Thank you for putting on this great show. And Don, you're the best. You're the best. You're the best. I've heard a lot of speakers. I love you. Thank you.
Thank you, Willie.